posters, stickers, CD, torch. Now, all this stuff is clearly the promotional material for some multi-million dollar movie like Armageddon or Godzilla. Except, of course, it isn't. Because unlikely as it sounds, all this is actually the byproduct of a film that cost around $35,000 to make, that was shot by two Florida film school graduates who'd never made a feature before and didn't even expect this one to get released.
Marketing was no longer just a profession. It had become like a contagious disease. Like a virus, widespread and deadly, this disease was infiltrating country after country, and now it was becoming more terrifying than ever. Even more frightening than the Blair Witch Project, a famous film from those years that was rumored to contain real footage discovered by the police. The footage told the chilling story of three documentary filmmakers. These three young people set out to make a documentary about a murderous witch, but strange things began to happen to them. The footage showed that they had disappeared in the Black Hills Forest. Viewers were left wondering, what happened to these three? The film was released just as the internet was becoming widespread. Websites constantly wrote about it, about the legend of the witch and the fate of the filmmakers.
The filmmakers also used the internet to draw the audience into their nightmare, publicizing the movie with a Blair Witch website which treated the events depicted as real. They fortuitously sparked off a network of mirror sites, all of which got the world believing in the mythology of the Blair Witch. I mean, why bother with huge advertising budgets when word of mouth, as it's now referred to, can put you in touch with armies of fans convinced that the truth is out there?
Audiences would send this content to each other via email, and this very act led more people to go to the cinema.
BlairWitch.com.
Really, the website was kind of like a medium for the mythology, so we all created the mythology and threw it up there as kind of for people to find out about. Ed formatted the site in such a way to where it was a kind of interactive experience.
The film quickly grossed $250 million. Even though its budget was reportedly only $200,000, it was a major victory for Artisan Entertainment, though it seemed a bit strange. But the big question was the story real? Websites claimed yes, it was completely real, but gradually it became clear that both the film and its marketing were a massive lie, a lie worth $250 million.
I just wanted the website to just kind of be this investigative website that basically treated this case as if it were real. And I think that's what people dug it. And so, you know, it just became kind of a playground, really, for a lot of people that were interested in the movie. And it generated an incredible fan base.
Of course, Artisan had deliberately orchestrated this lie. A lie that today is known as viral marketing. It's a form of advertising that was invented in that very decade, operating much like the spread of a virus. All it took was the creation of compelling content. The rest was handled by the digital world and its users. People thought they were sharing entertaining texts or images with their friends, but in reality, they were spreading a marketing campaign. That content quickly infected the minds of millions. There was no direct advertising. It was only about cleverly crafted seductive side stories.
So this is where the trail of the Blair Witch has led us so far. Where do we go from here? I have no idea because I'm completely lost in the dark. The only advice I'd give you is believe nothing you hear or read. Because in the end, the Blair Witch Project is everything you'd hope for and nothing you'd expect. And that really is scary.
Once again, Marketing had used a clever trick to pocket people's money, a trick made possible by the internet. For marketers, the internet was like the town square of the Middle Ages, a place to stir up commotion, a space that, in the modern era, was destined to become the central hub of marketing. The internet and smartphones transformed the path of advertising. These technologies were useful, but marketers preferred their darker side. To them, the internet cable was like a rope that bound the entire planet, creating something akin to a prison. A place where its inhabitants could be monitored and monetized. Critics called this phenomenon surveillance marketing.
And the question is, how can your brain be hacked? And the answer is, well, it doesn't get hacked with computer code, but it gets hacked with false information. And in fact, we've had false information since the time of the Romans. It's called propaganda. So what's the difference between marketing, which is what companies say they do, and propaganda? And the answer is the truth. That's the difference. When companies express a point of view that furthers their goals, then that point of view references true facts. That's called marketing. When a company expresses a point of view and tries to advance its goals based on misinformation, that's called propaganda. So the difference between marketing and propaganda is the truth. The corporations of America today have engaged in a very specific attempt to market their propaganda in order to get us to do different things than we might otherwise have done.
In this type of marketing, every behavior is a data point. Writing or searching for any word becomes content for analysis. Marketers, like prison guards, monitor every single action. They have a century of experience behind them and an ocean of information ahead. Our data is recorded and handed over to artificial intelligence. AI takes all the data and turns it into analysis, precise interpretations of our rational and irrational behaviors. Of course, irrational behaviors are a better raw material for marketers. The stranger our behavior online, the more diverse the data becomes. Diverse data leads to richer analyses, and these analyses form the foundation of prediction, predicting our needs, reactions, and thoughts. This information is highly valuable. The internet and surveillance marketing complement each other. It's a combination that creates the perfect opportunity for charlatans and the ideal space for selling products. Sometimes the product is an object. Sometimes it's an idea. Trump's election and that company's scandal were products of this era, an era of marketing abuse and exploitation of the human mind. Watching him raised another question. What will humanity's future look like under surveillance marketing? A future in which humans are the prey and marketers the hunters.
Before over a million times, who would ever thought that it would be our time? I just know it, 'cause you're the one.
of selfish love when I'm with you. Remind me of tomorrow so I know it's true. I'll just say it. You are the one. Won't you be my BFF forever? Won't you be my partner after this world? We'll see when we believe it together. The dreams are meant to be, 'cause you're the one. Every single day, I'll just say it, 'cause you're the one. And when times are tough, we've got the world to see. Standing right beside you is where I wanna be. I just know. Just over a million times. Who had ever thought that I could call you mine? I just know it, 'cause you're the one. And when there's gray in our hair, we've not much to do. I wanna spend the rest of my days with you. Oh, don't you know it? You are the one. Won't you be the one?
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Eruba Shavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Britain's far right on the march again in their biggest show of strength yet, led by a man who made his name scapegoating migrants and Muslims and spreading conspiracy theories. Simultaneously, a counter-demonstration organized by rights groups and unions against what they call racism and the rise of fascism.
Everyone should have free speech, but there's a defined line between free speech and hate speech, and some of the things he says is hate speech. So we have the freedom of speech to speak up and speak out about what's right and what's wrong.
I think it's a very cheap shot to point your finger at asylum seekers, people who are fleeing war-torn countries, wars that are created by the West. And, you know, I think it's we've got to show people like Tommy Robinson, who I hear is funded by Israel. You know, we have to show him what's what.
At the heart of the far right's rhetoric, immigration. They blame immigrants, especially non-Europeans, as the reason behind their economic woes. The counter-demonstrators here say the reasons should be sought elsewhere.
It's just a smokescreen. People need to wake up and realise that these people, these refugees who have come to seek solace in our country, are not the problem. They are not the problem. Look closer to home. Your government is your problem.
But that goes back to many, many years of austerity measures by the Tory government. I'm not hiding the fact that there's a lot of problems in this country in terms of like the economy, everything's been crashed, but it's not the refugees and the migrants that are to blame, but actually the politicians and their hypocrisy and their lies and their mismanagement of this country.
For 14 years, conservative governments imposed economic austerity while whipping up anti-migrant hysteria to distract from the damage. Under Labour, the promised change is yet to come.
They're angry with, and I understand some of the reasons they're angry, but I think they're blaming the wrong people. And yes, you have the right to free speech, but I think it should be based in fact. And a lot of their free speech that they claim isn't factual, and it's done to whip up anger, more anger for their own means.
Also tapping into that anger, right-wing Reform UK, led by wealthy politician Nigel Farage, whose party is rising sharply in the polls, with tackling migration top of his agenda if elected in the next general election.
At the heart of the problem, the demonstrators here say inequality, the failure of successive governments to look after the vulnerable, and the political system that fuels division rather than solving problems. Saipur is up, London.
On Monday, September 9, Ethiopia officially inaugurated the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam, Africa's largest hydropower project on the Blue Nile. Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed hailed the moment as a historic achievement for his country and the wider region. But as Addis Ababa celebrated, the spotlight quickly shifted downstream to Sudan, where questions about water security and the dam's impact on daily life remain unresolved.
The GERD is a strategic project for Ethiopia to meet its electricity needs. Egypt and Sudan fear possible risks, but in my visits, I have seen that for Sudan, the benefits outweigh the harm. It curbs floods, provides electricity, and engineers have assured its safety.
For Sudan, GERD offers both potential benefits and risks. Experts say it could help regulate destructive floods and provide more stable flows for irrigation and power. Yet Khartoum fears sudden releases, shortages during dry seasons, and the broader issue of dam safety. Located directly below the massive structure, Sudan is most exposed to any mismanagement, making daily coordination and transparency essential.
The matter doesn't end with this inauguration. Sudan and Egypt must take a strong stance to protect their rights through all legitimate means. As observers, we should put forward realistic, workable solutions. In my view, the only practical path is genuine joint management of the dam, where every decision is made collectively by all three countries.
Just hours after the inauguration, Egypt addressed the UN Security Council, emphasizing that it will not recognize Ethiopia's unilateral control over Nile waters and reaffirming the importance of international law. Previous trilateral talks among Ethiopia, Sudan, and Egypt failed to produce a binding agreement, leaving the dispute unresolved. Sudan, for its part, has reiterated its rejection of unilateral measures in the Nile Basin and remains committed to pursuing diplomatic channels to safeguard its national interests.
Standing here by the Nile, Sudan's lifeline, the concerns are clear. Beyond the promises of electricity and flood control, the real question is whether Ethiopia's dam will bring cooperation or deepen the uncertainty downstream. Abdullah Hussein, Khartoum.
Of the continuous genocide in Gaza by the Israeli occupation, many took to the streets of New York City to condemn the relentless and open-field bombing campaigns that have now left nearly 65,000 killed.
Protesters held banners calling for the freedom of Palestine and the end of the forced starvation of its people as they marched the busy streets chanting for an end to the occupation by Israeli forces.
To tell the world that this is a complete hypocrisy because they want to uphold international laws for other people, but when it comes to Gaza, absolutely no response. And we deserve to be treated like normal human beings, just like every other person, and everybody deserves basic human rights.
Protesters are demanding that the Israeli occupation be sanctioned and an arms embargo be put in place, especially after the IOF has called for the evacuation of Gaza under the guise of so-called safe zones. This comes after the genocide is nearing 2 years and the people of New York are saying and they demand an immediate ceasefire.
Appraisals were heard among the crowd for the global Sumud flotilla, which Israel has already attacked in Tunisia, as the flock of boats made their way to Gaza to break the imposed siege, while some protesters expressed hope in persevering until the siege is broken.
We have reached the point where Israel has turned the world into such a place where those who try to bring food are treated as criminals, while those who try to bring changes are treated as villains. And while those who orchestrate and lead genocides like Benjamin Netanyahu are treated with respect, are welcomed into the halls of international diplomacy.
I am seeing a slight shift, towards the better. It's going to be a tough fight. And we're going to fight harder. We're just going to keep fighting harder just to throw out our message that eventually Palestine will be free, and we need to save Gaza. We need to save Gaza now. No one is free unless Gaza is free.
With the UN General Assembly approaching in a week, people are already preparing to protest war criminal Benjamin Netanyahu's arrival to New York, while the international community continues to stay silent. Rachel Hamdouin, New York.
Genesis Cinema, a packed hall, watches From Ground Zero, a series of 22 short films by as many directors, spanning fiction, documentary, and animation. Made by young filmmakers inside Gaza as the Israeli genocide unfolds, the collection captures fragments of daily life in the territory.
For so many years, I was making Palestinian stories into cinema and showing them all over the world. For sure, when something like this happening, I need to share these stories with the world. I need to show what's going on in the small details of their life, far from the news.
One film shows the effects of Israel's starvation campaign. Another, musicians and vocalists refusing to surrender joy. And another, a husband remembering his last phone call to his wife and children before they were killed by Israel. Together, they show audiences the devastation, the heartache, and the determination of a people who continue to create.
The message I kind of take with me is that the children, no matter how much they're suffering, they are still able to tell stories of hope and to get over this. And I think within the sadness of it all, losing people, losing your home and everything, your identity, your being a Palestinian is what keeps them going.
I felt closer to the people that are actually in Palestine, especially because we actually heard names. So it's not just numbers. And I think it's very important to people know the actual names of the people that are there.
The films have already been shown at international festivals to rapturous applause.
The screening feels like more than cinema. It is a reminder that storytelling is an act of survival, with the directors insisting that their voices be heard. For the Palestinian diaspora, this is a bridge. For others, a chance to witness lives that are often reduced to headlines, demonized and dehumanized.
I think in spite of the darkness, the grief, the sadness that the film shows, you also get a perspective of hope. No matter what's happening, these are people who are attached to a land. These are people who are surviving colonialism. They're enduring a genocide. The easy option is walk out, get your freedom. But it's not freedom. It's removal from what's part of your culture. You might stay alive, but are you living if you're not on the land that it means more to you?
Supported by award-winning American director Michael Moore, From Ground Zero offers no easy answers, but it proves that even in the harshest of circumstances, art endures. Saeed Pourreza, London.
24 years after 9/11, a three-day conference was held in Washington called Turning the Tide, 9/11 Justice in 2025. 9/11 dissenters agree on a few core precepts. The official narrative is false. The World Trade Centers were demolished by pre-planned explosions and not only the airplanes. The attack occurred with the complicity of U.S. officials, and that 9/11 was pre-planned as a pretext for war abroad and a democratic rollback in the United States.
I think as time goes on, we get further away from the event, so people are less, feel a little less, say, traumatized. Younger generations start to look at the event. We do get, you know, new evidence comes about, and just in general, the taboo of questioning 9/11 starts to fade.
As we look at our world today, we're seeing more false flags, more lies, more stuff happening. These wars are endless. So unless we stand up and do something, the world's going to, I believe, go spiral down even more. So it's like what I say is we have a choice. It's either silence and complicity or it's doing something about it.
After 9/11, Western governments forced through unparalleled spy regimes, waged mass discrimination campaigns against their Muslim citizens, and fomented a hysterical war climate which largely endures today.
If 9/11 was perpetrated by Al-Qaeda, then why did Washington, Israel, and the West support the armed takeover of Syria by a longtime Al-Qaeda member less than a year ago? One wonders how the 3,000 people killed 24 years ago would react to this support for the alleged perpetrators of 9/11. If you look back at history, Al-Qaeda has been, you know, Al-Qaeda and Islamic extremists in general have been useful to the U.S. when, you know, either as soldiers or as boogeymen. You know, they could play either role for the U.S. And so I think this and many other things, you know, I would say many 9/11 families have questioned the official story for many years, and many are still fighting for justice.
A study from Brown University in the United States found that post-9/11 wars are responsible for the deaths of over 4.5 million people.
You're trying to get evidence, you're trying to get truth, and, you know, when someone is murdered, you normally have a murder trial. There's normally some degree of process to help that healing process, and we just haven't been given that.
Late last month, a federal judge determined that Saudi Arabia can face a civil lawsuit alleging the kingdom sponsored, aided, and supported the attack. 15 of the 19 hijackers were from Saudi Arabia. Rami Mazahiri, Washington, D.C.
Eternal Echoes of the Farsi-speaking World was the slogan of an event to celebrate the Farsi language in Vienna on Thursday evening. Hosted by the Iranian embassy, the event was held at the premises of the Diplomatic Society magazine.
It was a great opportunity to focus on the beauty of Persian language and also addressing some of very important topics relating to this language. We commemorate also Hafez Shirazi, one of the greatest poets of Iran and Persia, indeed. And also we addressed Cyrus the Great and his efforts and his legacy, and especially the Cyrus Cylinder, which is considered as the first human rights declaration all over the world.
It was the fourth time this annual joint event was organized by Iran with the embassies of Afghanistan and Tajikistan. Ambassadors and diplomats from many countries attended, like Oman, Democratic People's Republic of Korea, and Russia.
This evening is not merely a celebration of language, but of a civilization expressed through words. Farsi is more than a medium of communication. It's a repository of philosophy, spirituality, and art.
Tonight we have gathered in this beautiful garden in Villa Flora to pay tribute to these two towering figures of the Persian-speaking world, Hafiz, the poet of timeless wisdom, and Cyrus the Great, the visionary leader and founder of the Persian Empire.
Music from the three Farsi-speaking countries was performed, handicrafts were displayed, and the attendees enjoyed traditional food. This was the second cultural and religious event of the embassy in 3 days. On Tuesday, they celebrated the birth anniversary of Prophet Mohammed on their premises.
It has been another very successful event showcasing the Iranian culture organized by the Iranian embassy. This is testimony for the growing interest in the country's history, language, and religion in Austria. Another opportunity to display Iranian technology will be at the country's pavilion at the UN headquarters next week. Dieter Reinisch, Vienna.
From the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
The Flight Information Board in airports is a symbol of the fulfillment of a long-standing human desire. The desire to fly and the dream of reaching the whole world. Now the runways are full of airplanes and the airline route map is busier than ever. Airplanes have changed everything. A few hours of travel from one continent to another is only part of the story. Now global communications are influenced by the aviation industry, an industry that has overshadowed all aspects of life, from the movement of objects to the transmission of information and the flow of life. An industry that, of course, also has its dark sides, which were displayed in a strange exhibition.
When all that waste arrives at the airport, there's a limit to how much of it can be recycled because of international regulations. Here at Heathrow, 90% of cabin waste is incinerated or sent to landfill, and the airport wants governments to take a far more measured approach to that.
The exhibition was about waste. The seemingly ordinary waste that is produced on airlines. Things like disposable plates, spoons, forks, knives, glasses, headphones, and leftover food. On average, each passenger produces 1.3 kilograms of waste during a flight. Waste that ends up in the thousands of tons for an airline. Much of it is not recyclable.
With lots of that waste, we can't recycle as much as we would like to because it might have some food or some liquid that's contaminating it. So what we're really keen to do is to say, look, where a flight might be coming from America, where they've also got quite strict standards on food and plant health, we should be able to recycle more of that waste that comes off the plane.
Critics said that this waste was a serious threat to the environment, a threat that arose from our addiction to disposable tableware, a strange addiction that also exists in other aspects of life.
Getting a cup of coffee from a cafe may not seem strange. So does buying a sandwich from a fast food restaurant. Even buying a bottle of mineral water or repeatedly using plastic tablecloths. But these seemingly simple actions are also considered addictions of our time, an addiction that completes the puzzle of the threat to the environment. A puzzle that was only partially visible in the exhibition. Critics were wondering about the effects of this puzzle, that our addiction to disposable tableware was strange and bitter. By looking at that waste, visitors were supposed to think about the things they had simply passed by, about the utensils themselves, and about the history and why they were popular, things that were strangely related to the past, to the turbulent history of humans.
For the last month, I have been living just like the average person. Eating, shopping, consuming, just like so many of us are used to. But with one big exception. I had no garbage can. Instead, I had to wear every piece of trash that I created. Every coffee cup, every plastic bottle, every shopping bag, every to-go container, every Amazon delivery. So, why would I do something like this? Well, for most of us, our trash is out of sight, out of mind. We simply throw it in the garbage can and never think about it again. So I'm here to take you on a little journey.
When it comes to disposable tableware, a disease comes to mind, a mysterious disease that spread in Europe since the spring of 1918. The Spanish flu quickly conquered not only European countries, but the entire world. 500 million people were infected with the disease in a short time, and the death toll was reported to be dire. Some estimates say that between 50 and 100 million people were killed by the disease, that is, 1/20th of the world's population at the time. The number of deaths was so high that doctors began to think about treatment. Of course, there was no definitive cure for this disease. Perhaps that is why some people declared prevention as the cure. But the main problem here was that, in those days, prevention seemed questionable. In 1918, neither detergents nor disinfectants were widespread. Public health was much worse than it is today, and beyond that, there was no news of safe drinking water. In fact, not only was drinking water not available to everyone, but there was another problem, an issue called shared utensils. It had been observed many times that several dozen people were drinking from the same glass of water. This situation, which seemed normal until then, raised many questions with the spread of influenza. Doctors said that using shared glasses was an important factor in the spread of germs, a factor that should be quickly abandoned. They seemed right, but there was a big obstacle for people. There were not many glasses, nor did they seem easy to move and wash. A big problem that was solved by an old suggestion. The issue went back 2 decades, 2 years of alcohol addiction.
With the bar lined with the boys and bums, spending their money, debauching their characters, rotting their bodies, and jeopardizing their immortal souls.
In the late 19th century, alcohol consumption was more common in Europe and the United States than ever before. It got to the point where social activists warned about the consequences of this situation and churches took action. Religious organizations soon came up with an idea. They traveled from city to city to encourage others to not drink alcohol. These people went to different areas with barrels of water and wanted to replace the water with alcohol. Their idea worked quickly, but there was still a big problem. A problem that an American lawyer noticed. Lawrence Llewellyn realized that people were drinking from a common glass without cleaning it. Subsequent research proved to Llewellyn that this was a significant factor in the transmission of diseases, so he set about solving the problem. After several years of continuous work on the problem, it finally paid off in 1907. Llewellyn had invented a cup that could be thrown away after use. A strange cup called the health cup that could change everything. His invention was interesting, but it had a long way to go before it became widespread. A year after Llewellyn's accident, something else happened. A public medical health officer from the state of Kansas accidentally discovered the importance of disposable cups. Samuel Crumbin, while traveling on a train, noticed that all the passengers were using the same cup, a situation that, considering that one of them was sick, alerted Crumbin to the danger. After getting off, he decided to change the situation. Llewellyn's invention came to Crumbin's aid here. Crumbin and his colleagues soon announced that the use of shared utensils in public places was prohibited, a law that paved the way for the production of disposable utensils. With this law, disposable utensils quickly became widespread.
This glass looks innocent enough, but look. The whole family uses this germ carrier that's rarely washed, only rinsed. It can spread colds, flu, virus through an entire family. Replace it with the new Dixie Cup dispenser for the bathroom. See? Now, every member of the family can have his own clean Dixie Cup that can't spread virus, colds, or flu. New dispenser comes with 50 cups. Goes up so easily, even on tile, you can do it yourself. 100 Dixie Cup refills in the new blue box cost less to use than toothpaste. Put a Dixie Cup dispenser in your bathroom. See if you don't have fewer colds, less flu.
They could now be easily found in cafeterias, schools, and workplaces, a situation that continued until the end of World War II. Of course, the end of the war was the beginning of a new path. The plastics industry, which had been developing slowly until then, published its results in the mid-40s. One of the first results was none other than the work of American inventor Earl Tupper. Tupper had created a plastic container that had a simple but important feature. Tupper's container had a lid that could increase the shelf life of food and make it easier to transport. Of course, Tupper also had a big problem. Most people did not like the appearance of Tupper's products. That is why this American inventor asked a marketer for help. Brownie Wise soon came to Tupper's aid. A new name was chosen for his products, the Wonder Bowl.
This is Tupperware, the airtight plastic containers that keep good foods fresher longer. Here's how. Put in the food, put on the patented Tupperware seal, then press down the center of the seal and lift a little at one side. Hear that whisper? That's Tupperware's airtight promise to keep food's flavor fresh. Tupperware comes in all shapes, all sizes.
A bowl that was to accompany Wise to women's parties and gatherings. Wise had chosen the trick of selling person to person. Brownie women's parties were a place to show off these products. Parties that made the use of plastic containers in the home quickly became a fashion. A trend that spread to other sectors. In the mid-60s, Alan Frank reused the experiences of Tupper and Brownie. If adding a lid could make a container a bestseller, why not the same thing for cups? The lid could make disposable cups easier to use. Keep the temperature of the drink constant and ensure better hygiene standards. Frank's idea made disposable cups more popular than before, a popularity that quickly affected other aspects of life. A strange and long-lasting effect.
I've made it my life's mission to break free from consumerism, show that there's another way, and live in harmony with Earth, humanity, and all our plant and animal relatives. But for the last month, I have set my normal life normal life behind, and I have immersed in the consumer lifestyle. I didn't try to create trash, and I didn't try to avoid it. I simply floated along in the breeze of consumerism. I would go to the grocery store and look to see what was in other people's shopping carts, and that's what I'd buy. I'd go to a restaurant and I'd ask what's the most popular meal on the menu, and that's what I'd get. That's where this McDonald's wrapper came from around day 12, the Big Mac and fries.
A decade before the invention of disposable container lids, something else happened. In the mid-1950s, U.S. President Dwight Eisenhower issued a strange law, the Highways Act in the U.S. All states were to be connected from east to west and from north to south by a continuous network of modern highways. An ambitious plan that included tens of thousands of kilometers of roads. Long roads that also needed to provide welfare services for travelers. The first welfare service was nothing more than the provision of food, and urgently, a great challenge that coincided with another event. A few years before the Eisenhower plan, the McDonald brothers opened their first fast food restaurant in California, a restaurant whose idea was based on providing fast food, food that was ready quickly, sold quickly, and consumed quickly. Their initial customers were truck drivers who had little time to eat. Customers who soon took the McDonald brothers to the next level. The expansion of highways was what the McDonald brothers wanted. Now they could have a branch on every road to sell their products. Products that were ready in a few minutes, and their production process defeated the concept of time. Of course, it was not just McDonald's. It was soon followed by KFC. The secret to the success of this fast food chain was a combination of the need for fast food, the need for highways, and of course, one more important thing, something called disposable container, a phenomenon without which neither McDonald's nor KFC nor any other fast food would be able to expand or even survive. possibility that conquered other peaks during the 70s.
So it was about 3 weeks into the project that I found that I could no longer fit into the car. But I was still able to get into the hatchback of the Prius that we had and show up at one of the fanciest Hollywood restaurants where I knew the paparazzi would be waiting, and they were.
The lifestyle of Americans was something like the cars produced in those years. Fast, powerful, and of course, high consumption. Americans would ride these cars on the road and would definitely pass by McDonald's branches. Of course, things were no longer the same as before. Disposable utensils had managed to make it so that no one would even get out of the car, especially with the lids that Alan Frank had invented. Americans would enter the queue by car. Within a few minutes, they would get their food and drink and get back on the road. Now was the era of movement, the era of overcoming the time, and the era of disposable containers. An era that soon mysteriously conquered the whole world.
I'm a traveler, just as they were,
walking
the world, thinking of the past on an earth so vast,
waiting
to return. Just to know you, whoever you are, laugh with you, learn from you, open to you my heart. But soon when I say goodbye and move on, I'm a traveler just as they were,
walking
the world, thinking of the past on an earth so vast,
waiting
to return. Traveler, just as they were,
walking
the world, thinking of the past on an earth so vast,
waiting
to return, waiting to return.
for you, hope to meet you, my heart you have touched.
Remember me, so I might be with you. I'm a traveler, just as they were,
walking the world,
thinking of the past on an earth so vast,
waiting
to return. Waiting to return, waiting to return, return to my Lord.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, the worker. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, welcome to A to Z here on IRB English Radio with me, Sister Zainab. And so the title is The Worker, and by that I mean a person who has the sort of attitude or the demeanor of being very hardworking and really feeling so much in service, feeling so responsible, for example, towards the organization they're working for, especially if a person holds public office. Or then also, for example, if we're talking about a person who is on the battlefront and obviously is together with their fellow soldiers. So someone who then feels so responsible towards their fellow soldiers to sort of be there and also provide sort of encouragement and just keep the morale up by barely even taking time to recover from injury. So this is the sort of attitude that we see in all the martyrs of the Holy Defense. So they would typically, even though obviously they would have sort of leave from their active duties on the battlefront, very often we would see that they would actually cut their sort of break time short. For example, if they heard of, let's say, a new attack or a new operation, they would literally sort of maybe if they'd gone back to Tehran just to have maybe even just a week or so with their family, they would often cut it short and just head straight back to sort of really just want to be there to help their obviously their fellow soldiers. And obviously this is something we also see in, for example, with the famous martyr of service, the former president of the Islamic Republic of Iran, Shahid Raisi, who it said of him that he didn't even take one day off holiday in the 3 years he was serving. So, you know, these are the sorts of, these are the sorts of attitudes that are quite amazing, really. Welcome back to A to Z here on IRB English Radio with me, Sister Zainab. And obviously I'm talking about this idea that we really want to serve. And obviously we see this service always, as I've already mentioned, in all those who were in active duty, for example, during the Holy Defense, all the soldiers who were on the battlefront. And for example, one of the famous martyrs, Dr. Mostafa Chamaran, one of the martyrs of the Holy Defense, even when he was injured, he would sometimes sort of cut short his recovery time and sort of insist on sort of being back there amongst the soldiers. Or if he was, there's also a famous story where he was close to the front, I think. He was in sort of the south west of Iran just trying to recover from an injury. And it's really hot and the air conditioning didn't work and people were going to sort it out for him. He said no, he didn't want to have any more privileges or benefits compared to his fellow soldiers on the front. So it's this sort of idea. And then obviously we think back to ourselves, okay, so what do we do with this? And obviously there are two different viewpoints here. Obviously, the one is these are people who are in active duty, in service. So, for example,